I'm kind of waiting to be sure that the one who's taping is getting over to the tape room. I think that she may almost be there. And I also have on my watch 7, and the clock that's staring at me is 3 minutes after 7. Tonight, there's no going over because people are just going to start coming in for chapel. And that's my nemesis. Not chapel, time. Time is. I think we will begin. My name is Walt Wongren, Jr. Throughout this week, through tomorrow, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, the series that I've been offering I've called Tales Told in Context, because what I've sought to do each of these nights is to take a fiction that I've written and to set it into its spiritual, its experiential, its social, its relational context, so that you perhaps have some idea about how these flowers grow and for what purpose. On Monday, I offered you a story, Lily, which was written in response to a particular event, and the event was death, and it was a story told for children, and I wreathed for you the event around Lily itself. Last night, it was not a children's story. It was a little bit more heavy. It was Wask and Mani. It's a novel in process, and there, the context that I set it in was much more intellectual and doctrinal. It was the communication of discipleship and love and the complete and absolute love for Jesus Christ. Tonight, the context is relational. It's again going to be a children's story that I'll tell you, but specifically I'm looking at a relationship out of which or for which this story grew. Generally, the relationship is between adults and children that I'm thinking of, and that'll be the universalization of this story. Its name is Thistle. Specifically, the relationship for this story is between a parent, in this case a father, and a child, in this case a daughter. In this case, I'm the father, and Talitha, our youngest child, is the daughter. It's okay that I tell you her story because she's done with it now. And that's not a joke. There was a time when it was mostly her story, and now it's public and published, and so it's all right for me to tell it to you. But I want to set up, before I tell you this story, why it should come to be and how it came to be, both. I'll tell you in advance that a lot of this is instinctive. When a parent tells stories to a children, sometimes a parent is doing, I think, an extraordinarily psychologically blessed thing for the children and not altogether aware of what the blessings are. I was a little bit more aware than most, I suppose, because I have been writing stories for so long and because this was one means that God had given me for loving my children and for communicating with them. So I was mostly aware of the stuff I'm going to tell you in advance, but some of it I wasn't, and so I'm going to sound so smart to you and smarter than I really am. Dad and I, in these days, have been taking certain portions from Scripture and weaving them into our talk. This afternoon, Dad took Revelation chapter 5, and it became basis for his discussion about faith and science and how they may finally come together. I'm also going to take Revelation chapter 5. And I want to point out some ironies right here at the beginning, and then I'm going to ask you please to hold on to those ironies. I may not repeat them as we go on, but they are substantive to what Thistle does, which is why I think the telling of tales like Thistle is a spiritual activity. I do truly. John the Divine says, "And I saw in the right hand of the one who is seated on the throne a scroll written within and on the back, sealed with 7 seals. Dad said today that upon that scroll was written the history of humankind. And I like that. That all that had happened was written on that scroll front and back. That all that I have done as a father, let's specify that right now, as well as a husband and as a pastor and as a writer and as a human being and as one who walks the mountains and as one who stands sometimes pitifully before God and sometimes awfully before God, was written on that scroll, but it was sealed. It could not be opened. It's a sad thing. I would like to add that it's also possible that these scrolls were legal documents and that on one side of the legal document was the territorial rights which would be given or given to or inherited by children when the seals were broken. So we have not only all that was written of our lives on that scroll, which, when it is broken, I hope you're following me, stands under the grace of God. You want this to be broken open to stand under the bright sunlight of the grace of God. But also when those seals are broken and the scroll is unscrolled, then the blessings that God had held in store for the people are shed upon the people. Then the bequest is made real. Then all the beautiful territory without its sea but with its new sky and its new earth is there. Do you understand? But so long as the seals seal the scroll, these things are held back. By the way, I should say to the children who have come, be patient. We'll get to that story. We will, those of you that are sitting here. You might hook on to some of the stuff up to that story, but we have to allow for the fact that we've grown up and have to act grown up. And I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice, who is worthy to open the scroll and break its seal? So at first they look for worthiness. Now imagine what the world calls worthy. Imagine what children think worthiness is. Remember what you thought worthiness was when you were a child. I thought it was the ability to play soccer, as well as Nico and Theo de Hoog. I was in Canada at that time, and they were Dutch. And they played soccer so well, and I fumbled. I messed up. I was not very worthy. I thought it was the ability to fit into crowds and to speak the in language and to laugh at jokes. But I never got the jokes and I didn't know how to laugh. Who is worthy? I had some fool notions of worthiness. Strength, beauty, righteousness, wisdom. And no one in heaven, no one on earth, no one under the earth was able to open the scroll or look into it. And so all grace is withheld for a little while. And then John says, and I always love this humanness, and I wept much that no one was found worthy to open the scrolls or look into it. John was so sad that right there before the throne, tears flowed from his eyes and he sobbed, he wept. I have sometimes wept over my children, and I have sometimes wept over my unworthiness, and I have sometimes wept because my unworthiness has made my children feel unworthy. Then one of the elders said to me, weep not, lo, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has conquered so that he can open the scroll and its seven seals. Now here is the irony I want you to watch. This is a perfect children's irony. And between the throne and the four living creatures, it could have been any one of those living creatures, an ox, a lion, an eagle, a human face, mighty things, wise things, flying things, great things, strong things, could have been any one of those, but it wasn't those. Between the four living creatures and among the elders, I saw a little lamb standing as though it had been slain. Not only is it the weakest of creatures, not only is it the most sacrificial of creatures, one that can neither fight well, nor run well, kind of stumbly and sloppy. Please remember all these things. But it has a mortal wound. It's been broken. Somewhere along the line it was broken. This is an irony. This is a worthiness different, unexpected, paradoxical, different from all the worthinesses that the world might put forward or that little children might think are worthiness, that it should be the meekest of creatures. If any of you have read William Blake and the sweet but also powerful things that Blake has done with the lamb, you will know. With seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God, sent out into all the earth, and the lamb went and took the scroll from the right hand of the one who was seated on the throne. And then heaven burst open in joy. It was the lamb who was worthy. Let me begin with several questions, significant ones. How do you, adults, parents, how do you wipe the tears of your child? Where do you get the right to wipe the tears of your children if you are the one who caused them to cry? Now, to me, this is a very serious question. Because I have been the one who has caused my children to cry, sometimes rightly, sometimes in the role that God gave me as a disciplinarian, but sometimes foolishly and sinfully. And when I have made them to cry, then I'm overwhelmed with my feeling of guilt, generally by the time they are in bed and sleeping, and they are so sweet. And I'd say, why did I do that? And then I go through torments of guilt all night long while they're sleeping peacefully in the arms of God. How? This is a serious question, a practical one. How can you stanch the tears of the children whom you had caused to cry? Do you have the right? Can you find a way? How do you make a child, how do you persuade a child that she is beautiful when you have throughout the day persuaded her that she was ugly? How can you do that when you became one sort of, when you were one sort of advocate for a while, and just the overwhelming power of your presence and the feeling that you generated within that household made that daughter to feel as though she were somewhat ugly? Then how can you turn around and say, just a minute, kid, just a minute, let me unzip this personality. Zoop. Let me get into another wonderful character. Zoop. Now let me tell you, and believe me, you really are beautiful. How do you do that? How do you play those roles? How do you persuade a child that she is worthy when all the world implies that she is not? You know, coming up in inner city, that's where we live, and coming up black, as they say, sometimes puts a horrendous burden upon girl children, as well as upon boy children, but it's a different kind of a burden. Let's see if I can give it to you. When little, I should say black and poor, and then so it's also white and poor. Poverty, I think, is the main thing here, not race, but this is what we see where we are. In a household where there are boy and girl children, the girl children are expected to do the work. Do you know that? They are expected from as early as possible to do dishes, to wash clothes, to help mama, because mama is the one who is doing very much of the labor, whereas the boy children are little princes. They are free. And they are coddled and they are praised. Now, this is very, very brief. I won't have the time to go into it. But the consequence is a dual thing, and both are kind of deadly sometimes. The girl children get to be very skilled at self-survival. They can survive when they get older. The sadness for the boy children is that as they get older, they expect someone to help them survive. And so they will sit in the kitchen at a table when they're older, and they won't go so far as to the icebox to get a beer. They'll call someone else to get that beer and not think that that's bad. Whereas the girl children can do many, many things, but they have a very, very poor self-concept, because it was merely assumed that they would do all of this work. And they're exceedingly skillful. Their tongues are very good, sometimes very sharp, but nobody said that they were extraordinary good at it. It was taken for granted, their work. So then here comes my second question. How do you persuade the child that she is worthy when all the world says that she is not? Third question. How do you speak to a child when the child has a completely different kind of language than you have? We, dear adults, are rational. We speak in propositional language. Now I know that I've lost you altogether. We speak in propositional teaching kind of terms. We name things almost scientifically and empirically for what they are. We know what is alive and what is not. We know that the sun is not alive, don't we? We fools. We know that stones and rocks and things like that are not alive. We know what causes the wind, and we know the effect of the wind. We know all of those things. We are exceedingly rational. We have definitions that work for us on a noetic, intellectual level. How do we, with our kind of language, sit down and say to the child, "Child, you are, in fact, worthy, beautiful. Let me help you out of this problem that you're in." But the children, don't you understand, they know a different truth, and it is just as true. The sun is alive, and the wind blows. Blows, that's what the word. The wind blows. And they know that stones could think if they tried hard enough. They know that if a stone created a big enough thought, it might split into two. They know those things. They know what lives in the night, or maybe the problem is they know things live in the night, but they don't know their names. Bruno Bettelheim, whom I'm about to refer to, says that children solve their problems and communicate, this is significant, by their imagination. There's a drama going on always in their head. And that drama isn't just in their head. The drama is in the whole world. And it's very difficult for this child to know where the drama stops in her head and starts in the world. There is no division between her and the world. Now, that's not rational, but it's true. And we left that sort of a thing behind long, long ago. And so we try to ease the children with principles and facts and empirical data. Do you understand those words? No. But we do. Even if we're not particularly educated, we say things like, look, see? And they look and they see something totally different. How do you communicate with them when they dwell within their imagination? Do you remember? Do you remember, you grown-up adults who have left this long ago behind you? Do you remember when you walked to school? Do you remember when you had a test at school and it scared the living out of you? And do you remember as you were going nervous about this test, you said some very fool, silly things, but they gave you peace? You said, you picked up a stone, and you said, if I can throw this stone through those wires up there so it goes under the top two wires and over the bottom three wires, I'm going to pass that test. Do you remember that? Do you remember walking so that you never stepped on the cracks for all kinds of reasons? You didn't want to break your mother's back? Oh, let's see. Or you made up your own things. Do you remember that? And all those things were exceedingly real, and they caused for you both a sense of the livingness of the world and also a sense of security when you had gotten the rules right. How do you speak to children who dwell within their imagination? And then number four, and this is just as significant as the first three questions. If you're taking notes, it's number four. It's okay, kid. It's only adults who take notes. How do you help a child when part of the process of growing up is to grow into independence? This is a paradox. How do you let the child depend on you without becoming dependent? Do you understand what I'm saying? How do you set that child free, but how do you set that child free? How do you participate in that setting free without overburdening, overwhelming, dominating that child? Well, my answer is, and you've been hearing it, I hope, all the way throughout, I sincerely believe you tell that children stories. You put a third element between the two of you, which is really a single element that embraces both of you. You tell stories. Listen to what Bruno Bettelheim says. This is a book called The Uses of Enchantment. In order to master the... This is propositional language, so work at it. In order to master the psychological problems of growing up, and here are a bunch of them. Listen. Overcoming narcissistic disappointments. Oedipal dilemmas. Sibling rivalries. That means fighting with your brother or your sister. Do you have a brother or a sister? You have a sister? You have a problem. Well, sibling rivalries, that's what Bruno Bettelheim says. Becoming able to relinquish childhood dependencies, I've just spoken about that. Gaining a feeling of selfhood and self-worth and a sense of moral obligation. In order to do these things, a child needs to understand what is going on within his, her conscious self so that she can also cope with that which goes on in the unconscious. She can achieve this understanding, and with it the ability to cope, not through rational comprehension of the nature and content of her unconscious, but by becoming familiar with it through spinning out daydreams, ruminating, rearranging, fantasizing about suitable story elements in response to unconscious pleasures. But Bettelheim goes on and says that fairy tales have been the common and public daydreams which invite children into them and companion them. I'm not going to have time to walk through that whole thing. And companion them through. When I sit down and tell my child a story, the child has the independent right to say how true or how mythic that story is for her. She has independent capability with that story. She can laugh with it and say, it's just a story, Daddy. And there were times when this story, Thistle, for Talitha, was just a story. Just a fun story, something she owned. On the other hand, there are times when it was very clear to the imagination and the subconscious that this story was she and me walking through some very difficult stuff. But don't you know that stories have, now this is very simple, stories have a beginning and a middle and an end. And when you start at the beginning, the kid knows the end is coming. And so can stand a whole lot of horrendous stuff in the middle because the end of fairy tales is always good. All right? And since it's a third thing between us, even though I may be the ogre, as I tell a story, we can look at something else in that story, which is me, but which isn't me. And we can work through some of those problems together. Do you know how much children suffer loneliness for these problems? Just remember for yourself when you couldn't express it, and how dear a thing it is when somebody that is adult sits down and says, let me tell you the truth, let me tell you the story. And as the child hears that story, she's living in that story, and that's her. And here is a child, or an adult, nodding and saying, this is true, this is terribly important. It is as though in the storytelling, the adult, you're so unlucky you sat here. What is your name?
Jillian.
Jillian. Jillian, can you stand up? Do you mind that? Thank you. Come with me. Come up. Come to a higher place. Take my hand. This is what storytelling is. It's companioning. It's companioning. Jillian gets an ally when she becomes something in my tale. And even if I'm not in the tale, I'm with her in it. And we're saying together, this is terribly important. It's important that we go through this thing together. Poor Jillian, standing. Now do you see all these people out there? Does that nervous make you nervous? No?
A little?
You did good. Now they'll never forget this, that we held hands up here. This is storytelling. It's holding hands like this. It really is. Good, Jillian. Thank you, girl. You did good. You could sit down. And one of the beautiful things about fairy stories, and if you can tell that story carefully, one of the neat things is that within the child herself are the solutions to her problems, like the lamb. And even sweeter is that very often the very things that she thought were the least worthy about her, the most stumble-bumbish about her, the most problematical about her, are the very seeds and instruments of her solving that problem, whatever it was. You know the story of Rapunzel? Rapunzel, let down your hair. Both boys and girls listen to that story, and they understand what it means to be shut up in tight places. For some of them, it's a kind of a security, but it's a security they must break out of. Rapunzel, let down your hair. And do you know that this concept of letting down the hair is a sweet one unto the children, because it says something of their own bodies will set them free or bring them to relationships which are blessed. You remember the prince climbs up the hair and comes in. Do you see how that imaginary thing works? Hansel and Gretel, I'm sure that you can begin to understand the power of the problem behind that. Hansel and Gretel are taken into a woods and left there. It's an abandonment that I think most children at one time or another fear. Even when they're just in a store. Weren't you ever in a store with your parents? Your mama? And you squatted down by the toys? And your mama just went on round to the tomatoes? And then all of a sudden you looked around and she wasn't there, and it was a strange and terrifying world. And you didn't mind saying, Mama! Your mother minded. Well, I remember that. I remember being utterly terrified by that, and that was abandonment. That's Hansel and Gretel being abandoned in the woods. Now here is a neat thing. In that sense of abandonment, a Gretel can say, it's okay to depend upon my brother. It's okay for that dependency for a while. Why? Because later on in that story, it's Gretel who saves them both and pushes the witch into the oven. Do you see how these children begin in imagination to be able to work through some of this very difficult stuff? Let me show you, for example. Witches, ogres, giants, dragons, stepmothers. Well, here is an experience of a child. The child is going to bed at night. The mother comes in. Let's say that the mother is going out for the night, and she sits for a little while on let's make this a boy child, my experience. Sits on the edge of the bed where the boy child is about to go to sleep. Mother smells so good. She has perfume on. There's a mystery in perfume on mothers, and she's got lipstick on. In those days, bright red lipstick. Not glossy, just plain old smear, bright red lipstick. And she says wonderful, wonderful things to this boy who is lying in bed, and in his heart he is saying, oh, the princess. Oh, the beautiful one. And she says, I'm going to go out now. And he says, but can you leave a mark? And she says, I'll leave you a mark. And she leans over and she kisses him on the forehead real hard, big smack. So there's a red mark on the forehead. And he closes his eyes, and it's sweet to have such a mother. And he falls asleep dreaming of princess. The next morning he gets up, and it's a school morning. And somebody downstairs says, get up! Why are you in bed so long? He can't believe it's the princess. Down he comes, into the kitchen he goes, and here is another person standing at the sink. whipping up suds, whipping up food, whipping up children, whipping up the air and so forth. But he still thinks this is his mother. And he sweetly goes up and pulls on her nightgown. Tug, tug. And she says, what? Not ready yet. When are you going to get your clothes on? I've just made the food. It's drying over here. Get. What is the child to do? Well, the child is going to save the mother. This happens also father-daughter, as you'll hear in my story. The child saves the mother. How? By dividing her into two people. There is a princess and there is a witch. And somehow both of them live in his house. Now that way he can love the princess and look out for the witch. And this is how the imagination works. The same thing happens with the male image. By the way, those of you who are stepmothers, even though they get bad press in the Grimm's fairy tale, you ought to know that the children don't identify it by the name, mother, stepmother. They identify it by the actions or the feelings. A true blood mother can feel like a stepmother, according to the tales, and the children make that distinction, okay? So that you know. It's the tales that set them free. It's the tales by which they can live through these things ever before they come to rational minds. This is what Bettelheim says. And this is what I did. For my children, I told stories. I don't have the time to tell you all four that finally ended up for them. Joseph's is in here. It's called Moses Swope. Moses Cornelius Mortality Swope, because my son believed everything that was told him and he suffered his faith. Matthew's never has been published, but it's called The Otter and the Oak. Mary's is going to be Mary, Elizabeth and the Water Troll. That will be published. And Talitha's is Thistle. That was published some time ago. Now here is the setup, because Talitha played a role in this story too. Talitha is the fourth of our four children, the youngest. And so there's two boys, Joseph, Matthew. And by the way, when this story was written, Joseph was the tallest in the family. Matthew was very conscious of strength. Matthew was born being conscious of strength. He could pop muscles in his back. We adopted him at 3 months, and he was already flexing back muscles on the way home. Mary, blonde-haired, broad smile, beautiful, beautiful Mary, and Talitha. Those are the four children. Talitha doesn't do these things anymore. She doesn't need the story anymore. And now she's beautiful going on to beautiful. When she was a child, however, sometimes Talitha would cry. And sometimes she got guffed for her crying. Because Talitha had the wonderful ability to cry from every hole in her head. She would cry drool out of her mouth. It wasn't beautiful. She would cry, what do you call, out of her nose. Her eyes would run great, great, great gobby tears down so that her whole face became like, and she would sob. She really sobbed good. The problem with sobbing in church, however, when the father is trying to preach sermons, is that everybody hears the child sobbing and all their hearts break for this broken-hearted child. Well, I'm trying to tell them about God. And of course, the problem was at home is that she got teased for her tears so often. And I was not always a good father. I'm not still a good father, and I'm aware of that. I would come home from my work, and I would shout. I am exceedingly rhetorical. I may raise my voice good, even without a microphone. My disciplining of my children were wonderful Martin Lutherish sermons upon my children. 3 points, one after the other. Generally, law, shut up, sit down. It's marvelous to me how I can sit down at supper with all of my children and say to myself, 3 rules is enough. Just 3. They can't handle more than 3. But before supper is over, I have begun to say, chew with your mouth shut, for heaven's sake. How many times have I put your chair down? You don't lean back in your chair. I've told you that over and over. And look, you spilled tomatoes right off the plate there. You have to, and the floor is getting absolutely filled. Don't talk with your mouth full. What is the matter with you children? Just to give you a little sense of what kind of a father I have been. And it happened especially when things got taught at church. When I would go to meetings and nobody else showed up. This was something they didn't tell me in the inner city Grace Church, that you could call for meetings and you were the only one who showed up and there might be somebody else and the two of you would sit there. And I would smile beneficently on the people of Grace. I would be so kind to them. But when I got home, I allowed it all to come out upon my children. And it was often Talitha, because she was the youngest, who would bear the burden of this stuff, and she would cry. She would cry from her nose, and she would cry from her mouth, and she would cry from her tears. Now, here is the kernel of this story for me. I got it from Talitha. One day when I came home, all tense and smiling with all my teeth, it's a terrible sign of the people. Dad is trying to be a Christian. Talitha said to me, and I hooked onto it. You must remember this. Talitha said, little child, she said, Dad, your work eats you up, doesn't it? She said, Dad, your work eats you up, doesn't it? And that became the core to this story called Thistle. And I thought, this child, and there were times, in fact, when Talitha would even say that she'd like to hear, I thought, this child needs that kind of a story between the two of us that will teach the sweetness of the Lamb. I didn't think that, specifically, that image. But I did think, in this child, there is love. How can I tell her the beauty of her love? And how can I make these things that are the most unworthy be worthy? So I told a story called Thistle. Thistle. Now, would you all just pretend you're my children? Let's do that. Pretend that it's the nighttime. Say that during the day you said to me, Dad, tell me Thistle. And I understood that you didn't want an entertainment. I understood that you needed some order in your life. And so I said, I will. And then we went the rest of the day knowing that that was going to happen. Understand that that was easiness for you. And then pretend that when it came time for you to go to bed, I came to your bed. And I began to tell you this story. Now you can do with this story as you please. Live into it or stand back and chuckle at it. Allow it to be real or allow it to be a fairy tale. But you be my children. I tell you. Once upon a time, there was a man and a woman who lived in a potato house. That doesn't mean that the house was made out of potatoes. You know better than that. That was what the man did. That was the man's job. He grew potatoes. All day long, this guy would go out into the fields, and in the spring, he would plant these eyes that he'd sliced out of potatoes into the rows. He would hoe, and he would allow them to grow, and he would, when the time came, harvest the potatoes. That's what he did. All day long, he worked in the potato field. And then when it came time for lunch, this fellow, this is an old story, okay? I've learned a whole lot since, all right? I've learned an awful lot since. This fellow would come home at precisely noon and kick the door open, boom, boom, and say, I'm hungry. Where is my lunch? They lived well together, this man and this woman, for a while, except that they had one problem. They had no children. And they prayed to God that God would give them children. Now, sometimes I could tell this story, and I could talk real long about the coming of the children, or I could get through it real quickly. You know that a story is telescopic, don't you understand? You can make them fit the day. So let's say then they prayed to God, and God gave them their grant. They had a boy. And it was a handsome, tall lad, kind of green in his hair and green in his eyes, stood tall and proud. We don't want to say arrogant, but we might. And the man and the woman thanked God for this child that had come into their house, and when they looked upon the straight tallness of this boy, they said, he is Pine. They said, his name is Pine. Well, they continued to pray. They didn't know when they had enough. And God kindly gave them another child. We can shorten this whole section because we don't have to go through all the stuff of childbirth and so forth. And the next child that came out was strong. Came out popping his muscles. He could flex his forearms and he could flex his biceps, and he had triceps that nobody could count. All up and down his back, he could ripple the muscles over his ribs. He could make it flow, the muscles, and he could make his legs pop. And they looked at this child and they thanked God that they had such a strong child next to this tall first child, and they said, Oak, this child shall be called Oak. And so it went for a while. And then God blessed them again, and they had a third child, and this was a girl. This was a beautiful girl. She was so beautiful that when the wind came and the wind blew across her pale red cheek, the wind moaned for love of the child that it touched. And they said, Rose, we will name this child Rose. And then came a fourth child. She wasn't tall. She wasn't strong. She wasn't pink. She was kind of butterscotch, matter of fact. She was smaller than the rest, and she had trouble talking, but she cried all the time. She always did cry. She would sometimes stumble when she walked, and she had trouble holding dishes straight up and down. And the man and the woman were honest, and so they said, "We will call this one Thistle." But they loved this one. They loved this one, equal to how much this one needed their love. And so it went. And so it went for many years. The man would go out into the potato field, and the kid stayed at home. And sometimes when Pine would walk by Thistle, he'd say, "Oh, Thistle, you are so short." And sometimes when Oak went by Thistle, she would say, "Ah, Thistle, you are so weak. Where are your muscles?" And sometimes when Rose went by Thistle, she just didn't say anything at all. She just kind of looked from the sweetness and the power of her beauty and sighed for Thistle. And Thistle would cry. It wasn't an easy life for Thistle always. But the man would come home at noon and he'd kick in the door and he'd say, "I'm hungry. Where is my lunch?" And they would all sit down and they would eat. Stroke on noon. Now, one day it happened that while the man was out working, digging potatoes up, it was harvest time, he came upon a wonder, he came upon a marvel, something that he had never seen before. First, he had dug with his shovel, and he came upon something that was very, very large, so that he got down on his hands and knees, and he began to shovel the dirt away from it. And he recognized that what it was, Julian, it was a potato. It was a huge potato. It was the biggest potato that he had ever seen in his entire life. And this was marvelous to him. He pushed all the dirt away from this potato and saw that it had tubers, two on the side and two on the bottom. And while he was digging at this potato, all of a sudden, it opened up one of its eyes and stared right at the man, who leaned back. This to him was a marvel that his own work was looking back at him. And while he looked at this potato with its one eye looking at him, all of a sudden all the eyes on that potato started popping open one after the other and staring right at that man. He thought that he ought to say something, but he didn't know what to say. But where he had problems talking, this potato didn't have any problems at all. This potato said, lying down in its socket in the earth with its thousand eyes rolling around, it said, "My name is Pudge." And it began to move its two tubers, and they were like arms, and it pushed the dirt away, and its bottom tubers began to make it, and it said, "And I am hungry." And it looked right at the man, and it said, "And I mean to eat you," which is what it did. Ate the man up, shovel, shoes, and all. And got up on its two round tubers at the bottom and began to lump through the potato field to the house, stroke on the time of noon. And exactly at noon, it was outside of the door, and all the children are inside, and they are getting ready to eat, and the door boomed open, boom, like this. And there stood Pudge with thousands of eyes looking in the room, overlooking Pine so tall and Oak so strong and Rose so beautiful and Thistle who was beginning to cry and the woman who was in the back, and it said, "My name is Pudge and I am hungry." And it looked straight at the woman and it said, "And I mean to eat you," which is exactly what it did before the eyes of four children who had no idea what in the world they should say or do. And then it turned around on its tubers and it walked out of the house. Well, they stood there stunned that a potato should come in and eat their mama and their papa right up. There was no mama nor any papa left. And they looked around and they heard a strange noise in the house, and back in the corner there it was Thistle. And they said, "Thistle, can you do nothing but cry?" "No," they said, "no, nothing but cry." But they were a hopeful band, these four children. And it was Pine who stood up right in the middle of the house. Pine said, "I am the tallest. I am the oldest. Therefore, it falls to me to go out into the wide world and find some kind of weapon with which we may fight this Pudge and save ourselves." Well, all the others patted Pine on the back and said they were so glad they had a tall and an old brother. But Thistle, she was crying over here. She was crying because she loved Pine. And she was worried what would happen to Pine when Pine went out into the broad world and tried to find some kind of a weapon. And Pine said, "Oh, Thistle, hush up. You can do nothing but cry. You can do nothing but cry." But Pine was brave. Into the world went Pine. Pine walked all over the fields. Doesn't matter where he walked. Depends upon the night when I was telling the story. He could go through the woods. He could go through the cities, always looking with a certitude that he would find it for something with which he could fight this pudge. As he was walking, however, he passed a stump. And on that stump there was a living being. It's kind of hard what to call her. She was a witch. Now, you must understand that this was a most ugly witch. She was crouched down so low, like a frog. You know how a frog sits? She was sitting like a frog. Her knees went up higher than her head, like this. She was crouched down. She had a long nose, 10 inches. Her nose went 10 inches out in front of her face. She had a long chin, 10 inches, went out 10 inches in front of her face, so that when she talked, it looked like calipers or scissors opening up and shutting, and her nose was drooling drips of snot, which kept landing on the bottom of her chin. She had 3 hairs on top of her head, just 3 hairs, and very, very narrow eyes. And she stopped him. She said, "Laddie, laddie, where do you think you're going?" Now, this was just beneath Pine. The witch was short. The witch was ugly. Pine said, "None of your business, woman." She said, "Are you going to find some way to fight Pudge?" Don't ask me why she talks like that. That's just the way she talks, this witch. Well, that stopped Pine, because she knew something. He said, "Yes." Little bit suspicious, little bit hesitant. "Yes, I'm going to fight Pudge." She said, "Laddie, give me something you have no use for. Give me something you don't need, and I'll give you a weapon with which to fight Pudge." Well, Pine liked and did not like what he heard. He liked the possibility that he might get a weapon, but he didn't like that he didn't know what he was supposed to give her. He said, "Woman, what do I have that you want that I don't need?" She said, "To see my nose. To see my chin." She said, "Been a long time since any laddie's kissed me." She said, "Laddie, give me a kiss. Just give me a kiss, and I'll give you a weapon with which to fight Pudge." Well, Pine looked down on this ugly, squat, short creature and said, "Kisses, kisses. I've got no kisses for anybody such as you. But you give me the weapon, and I will fight Pudge." Her eyes went like slits in her head. Narrow, narrow. And if you had been there, you would know that those narrow eyes were narrow for anger. But she smiled, twisted smile on her face. And she said, "Laddie, you go home. I'll give you something. You shall have roots." Roots. Pine had no idea what roots were. But he felt that anything that anyone would give him would certainly be good enough with which to fight Pudge, because he was so tall and so arrogant. Home he rushed as fast as he could go. When he came into the house itself, it was almost noon. He had all the kids get back out of the way. He took up his place in the middle. He said, "Wait, wait, I will get Pudge." The door on the stroke of noon burst open. There stood that ugly Pudge with 1,000 eyes rolling all over, staring in, and Pine stood tall. Pudge said, "My name is Pudge, and I am hungry." And looking straight at Pine, he said, "Toothpick, I mean to eat you." Pine got ready to fight. He got ready to find out what roots were. He was proud, and he was ready. And as soon as Pudge started walking into the house, Pine found out what roots were. He couldn't move. They kept him solid to the ground. There wasn't a thing that he could do. He couldn't even cry. Pudge ate him. Toothpick. Swallowed him down, turned on his tubers, and walked out of the house. Pine was gone. Thistle was crying. She knew. She knew. She wished he hadn't gone. And they said, "Oh, Thistle, can you do nothing but cry? No, nothing but cry." And then, well, you can imagine. Oak said, "Pine was a fool." Oak said, "Pine was just proud and arrogant and tall. I'm strong." So Oak said, "Leave me alone. I'm going into the world, and you can get exactly what happened." Out in the world went Oak, flexing his muscles, trying to make noise wherever he went. He was a whole army in himself. He passed the witch. The witch said, "Laddie, where be you going?" He didn't even answer her, because he was about military things. and she didn't look militaristic at all. But she talked to him, same as she did to Pine, and said, "If you give me something that you don't want, I'll give you something that you do need, and you can fight Pine." He said, "Give it to me. Give it to me right now." She said, "No, no, wait. Let's strike the bargain. You give me a kiss, I'll give you a weapon." He said, "Kisses, kisses. I have no time for kisses. Muscles, right? No kisses for muscles." She said, with her eyes so slitty, "Slitty as knives," she said, "thou shalt have roots." And home he went, like the wind, sure that roots were something with which to beat up Pudge, right? Took his place up in the middle, made Rose stand back, made Thistle stand back. Thistle is crying, she knows what's coming. Here comes Pudge. Oak finds out what roots are because he cannot move, and Pudge... Well, you can imagine how this goes, right? I mean, you are intelligent children. The only difference with Rose was, you're not an intelligent child, Julian. The only difference with Rose was, is that Rose thought that she knew what roots were and she was going to play it back upon Pudge. She went out there, she met the witch. She said, "I give kisses to whom I please and I have very few." She said, "Give me the roots. I'm going to use them." And the eyes are so slitty on the witch, who simply could hardly talk to so much beauty, stunned by the sunlight of this rose. Rose went home and made Thistle stand in the back like that and stood there, tossing her tresses, waiting for the roots to come. And of course, here came Pudge. Pudge stood in the doorway. Rose was sure that the only thing that her brothers didn't have was coolness, beauty, mystery. And she stood there with her mystery and a bit waited for the roots to come. And Pudge came in, Pudge stunned with dessert. And when the roots came, old Rose started tossing them like tresses over the back of Pudge. Thistle back here saw Pudge get so close to Rose. Thistle said, "Rose!" Rose turned around and said, "Thistle, shut!" Pudge had dessert. All of them were gone. Now you must understand this. This is a very sad part of the story, and it really is sad. Thistle is all alone. Her mama and her papa have been eaten by Pudge. And she loved Pine, and she did love Oak, and she loved Rose for their... light and for their strength and for their beauty, and she is all alone, and she cries. She's sitting in the house all alone now, crying, and all the water is coming out of her eyes and out of her mouth and out of her nose, and she says, "Oh, Thistle," she says, "Thistle, can you do nothing but cry?" And she says, "No, nothing but cry." Now there is nothing for her to do, and there is nowhere for her to go, and out the door she walks. She wanders, crying. She's blinded to the world. She can hardly see the world because of all the tears that are in her eyes, this Thistle crying. And as she walks along, she wails. Her mama is gone. Her daddy is gone. Her brothers and her sister are gone. And she starts naming them aloud because she is so sad. She says, "Mama, Daddy, where are you?" And she says, "Pine." She says, "Oak, where are you?" She walks through a potato field, a sad girl, all by herself. She walks through the forest. She says, "Rose, I love you, Rose. Where are you?" And then all of a sudden, a voice says, "I know those." And she stops. She can't see very clearly for her tears. It's the witch sitting on a stump with its knees higher than its head. 3 hairs on her head. 10 inches of a nose, 10 inches of a chin, snot dripping, drip, 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 to her chin. She says, "I know those 3. You said Pine, did you?" And Thistle wipes her eyes and sees all this toadish ugliness sitting on the stump. And she said, "I said Pine." "You said Oak, did you? You said Rose, did you?" She said, I said oak, I said rose. She said, I know those three. And right away, Thistle thought that anybody who would know those three must be a good person because she loved them so much. She said, the witch said, she said, do you want something with which to fight this pudge? Thistle said, yes, no, I don't know. She said, the witch said, she said, child, if you give me something that you don't want, I'll give you something that you need. Will you do it? And she said, yes. She was crying. All she could think of was her sadness, don't you know? And she felt that if there could be some happiness in the world somewhere, she was glad to do it. Yes, said the witch. You don't ask what it is. No, said Thistle. The witch said, child, let me kiss thee. And Thistle said, okay. She wouldn't mind at all for somebody to kiss her now. And so the witch came down off the stump, slithered like a snake over to where Thistle was, nose and chin first. And it was a marvelous thing that the witch did, because she kissed Thistle. She kissed her, this is marvelous, with the nose and the chin in the way. But she was precise in her kissing. She kissed every tear that Thistle cried. Every single tear on her shoulder, on her back, on her neck, on her face, on her face, on her face. She kissed all the tears. And every tear that she kissed turned into a thorn. And she crawled back. And just before she disappeared into the stump, she said, Capape, go home, child. Go home. Sit and wait for Pudge. We will see what we will see. And she said, one child is weaponed now. Well, Thistle did as she was told. She went back home again, and she sat down in the middle of the floor. That is where Pine had stood, and where Oak had stood, and where Rose had stood, and where their mother was standing before. She just sat there, and right at the stroke of noon, the door burst open. And there was Pudge, huge, because he had a whole family inside of himself now. Thousands of eyes rolling around through the house, and all he could see finally was Thistle sitting right there. He said, my name is Pudge. And Thistle said, I know. He said, I am hungry. She said, I thought as much. And he moved up to her with his enormous maw, and he said, and I mean to eat you. And she said, okay. Pudge opened up this huge, huge mouth, and he swallowed the child down, Thistle, thorns and all, smacked his lips, and began to feel a pain in his throat. And the pain in his throat was like a fire, and it began to go all the way down into his chest. And he coughed, and he choked, and he started hollering, but my name is Pudge, he said, and I'm the one who's hungry, he said, but who is eating me? Because all of the thorns on the thistle were pricking on the inside of Pudge. Every single thorn was a fire. Every fire was burning hot inside of Pudge. It made a pain. Oh, children, it made a pain inside of this huge Pudge. A pain that grew bigger and bigger until all of a sudden it split Pudge open right down the middle. And out stepped the papa. And out stepped the mama. And out crept Pine. And out came Oak, and out came poor bedraggled Rose, and the last one of all to come out was Thistle. And they said, Thistle, they said, Thistle, you have saved us. It was the father whose work ate him up, who was able to put his arms around Thistle and hold her so tight because the thorns were gone now. Now they were petals, and to squeeze her so tight because he said, it was you, Thistle, it was your crying that saved us from this Pudge. And they danced, this family, and Rose thought that it might be good to try to find a blue flower that would look like a thistle. And Pine stood tall for Thistle thereafter, and Oak went around looking for anybody who would touch his sister, Thistle. And out of Pudge, they made potato soup. Dear children, I could tell you that story long, and I could tell it to you short. And I could explain some things to it, and I don't have to explain a word at all. I say you cry, and I say they mock you for your tears. But I say to you, your tears are beautiful, they are weapons. Because there was a time when I was lonely, my child. When I was so lonely and caught up. But the one thing that set me free from my loneliness and from my terrible, terrible work were your tears. It was your tears which were my love. Oh, my child, I say, without saying a word, because it's the third thing between us. How much I love you, I say. How much I love you. And Talitha could say to me at the end of the story, "Oh, Daddy, is that true?" And I would say, "Talitha, it's a fairy tale."